You are listening to an exclusive podcast on Money Control.
Hello and welcome. As we hurtle towards the last phase of the general elections, we've seen an ugly contest unfold. The heat is notched up and the dust kicked up is a veritable storm. In fact, there is a dust storm right here in Delhi. A lot of the conversations, at least in some circles, as I have observed, have veered towards India's foreign policy evolution in these Modi years. On this edition of Digging Deeper, we try to decode just that, how India represented herself in the last 5 years on the international stage. But in this first part of the two-part series, or special, we will address the evolution of India's foreign policy, how we are and what we have become since independence. When we return for the next part, we will examine the Modi years. This is part one of our two-part series, India and the World. My name is Rakesh Sharma, and you're listening to Money Control,
the Deep Dive podcast series.
On the 26th of March 2019, Uzair Yunus, director at Albright Stonebridge Group, wrote in The Diplomat about India's evolution from what was earlier a protest voice on the world stage. The article calls the recent India-Pakistan crisis as a testimony to the fact that big guns like France, Germany, Australia, and the United States are willing to stand behind India in the international arena. The fact, though, is that in the context of Pakistan, India has always wielded more power and enjoyed more credibility in the international arena, while Pakistan, despite being a strategic ally of China and the US for geographical and tactical reasons, has always been known as a bit of a loose cannon internationally because of its inner instability, its soft stance on terrorism, and poor democratic credentials. All the things that India's sturdy democratic values have not been associated with. It is important to understand that a country's international credibility has a lot to do not just with how it deals with allies and adversaries, but also its own internal matters. US President Donald Trump, for example, does not enjoy the respect internationally that President Obama was accorded because of his inability to understand not just the fundamentals of foreign policy and international relations, but also the tenets of a functioning democracy in a country that was once known as the leader of the free world, or a shining house upon a hill, as Reagan would say. President Trump might claim that we are now finally respected by the world, etc., etc., in his own voice, but the truth is, that is not true. The Diplomat also delineates India's strategic outlook in the early decades post-independence as a foreign policy that was built on three key pillars. Number one, non-alignment in the international arena. Number two, preservation of autonomy in domestic affairs. Number three, solidarity among developing nations, particularly those that had recently gained independence from colonial powers. This policy continued throughout the Cold War, when India leaned toward the Soviet Union while deftly maintaining strategic autonomy and charting its own course in a bipolar international order. That, of course, began to change a little after the collapse of the Soviet Union. There was, of course, also an economic crisis looming large at home. Yunus went on to continue on The Diplomat, and I quote, "India slowly opened its economy through careful economic liberalization that signaled the end of the license raj and at the same time began to engage with the rest of the world on a different set of norms," unquote. The high rates of economic growth ushered through domestic reforms attracted international investors, and India's strategic thinkers quickly captured this opportunity. Economic attractiveness gave the country space to engage with the rest of the world on its own terms. This meant that India would not give in easily on strategic issues, but it would at the same time be flexible and engage with the rest of the world to achieve win-win outcomes. Unquote. Now, according to Yunus, India seeks to position itself among the great powers by showcasing a willingness to take on more international responsibilities to achieve the holy grail in the international order, which is, of course, a permanent seat at the United Nations Security Council, something only 5 countries enjoy: US, UK, Russia, China, and France. Well, one of the questions we are asking is just how much is the hyperbole connected with PM Modi's legacy as global leader to do with projection rather than facts? Is it just uncomfortable hugs and undiplomatic first name calling, or is there actually something in the way he has changed India's standing in the world after all? We try and unearth some of those answers in this two-part series. The Diplomat talks about 3 emerging shifts in the international order in recent times: terrorism, climate change, and the rise of China. Before we start understanding how India has dealt with in each of these areas, let's take a look inward for about a second. If you look at recent events, the Indian leadership's repeated failure to stem domestic terrorism and caste and religion-based violence, the electoral strategy of using the bogeyman of the National Citizenship Register, giving an election ticket to a terror accused in Bhopal, etc., belies the government's commitment to deal with terror impartially on the world stage, especially when in recent times it has shown no qualms about extending a warm welcome to the likes of Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, that is MBS, whose record of human rights violations on domestic soil and his role in terror funding has been critiqued internationally. This is, of course, not just in relation to the Jamal Khashoggi case, where it has been alleged that the Washington Post journalist was murdered at the behest of MBS. While the current dispensation may condemn terrorism on foreign soils on occasion, like in New Zealand, like in the US, etc., its record on internal terrorism is at best inconsistent and at worst unacceptable. Now, if that's how we've dealt with terrorism, the other big issue that has been emerging as a shift in the international order relates to climate change. India's commitment to reducing emissions from oil-based engines has but remained a pipe dream. Though not strictly related to climate change, let's take the issue of air pollution, for example. 14 of the 20 most polluted cities in the world are in India. That is not a statistic you see peddled on the WhatsApp forwards from your relatives. Diplomats on placement here in India get something called a hazard pay, meaning they get extra money for agreeing to work in a region that is dangerous, something you would expect in a war-torn country. Not a good look. Even a cursory Google search will tell us that air pollution alone ranks higher than smoking, high blood pressure, child and maternal malnutrition on the list of public health issues which could turn to mortality. India is in fact the third largest after China and the United States in the generation of greenhouse emissions. The Paris Agreement that we are a part of is not a national achievement. Merely setting a goal of installing clean energy capacity that would equal 40% of the country's total energy capacity by 2030, which is what they've said they would do, does not take away from our inability to protect ecologically sensitive zones or silence the alarm bells frequently rung by the likes of Greenpeace, which only recently said that Delhi topped the list of the most polluted cities in the world. The US-based Health Effects Institute report also revealed that around 1.2 million people were killed in India in 2017 due to air pollution. 12 lakh people. Not to forget, of course, the Prime Minister's own befuddling statement that it is not climate that is changing, but our ability to endure it. Very much like the pronouncements of one Mr. Trump. And now for the third point that the diplomat raised. How has India benefited from China being viewed as a strategic competitor by the United States and its allies? We'll of course try and explore that question in detail in part two of the special, considering China's repeated provocations regarding Arunachal Pradesh and the several other geographic and territorial issues at stake here. But so far, not so good. Before we understand how we fare in the present, let us go back a bit in time to see the distance we have travelled or not in the international context. An article was presented at the India Forum, organised by the Fundación Marcelino Botín, that is Marcelino Botín Foundation, in Madrid in November 2007. Written by Xenia Dormandi, the piece explored India's role as an emerging global political force. The story begins with a quote from then Secretary of State of the United States, Condoleezza Rice, who had said in March 2005 that international institutions are going to have to start to accommodate India in some way. As the article puts it, from an Indian perspective, she was years late. But it is an objective that the developed world is only now beginning to affirm and towards which it is still only taking hesitant baby steps. And as the writer put it, in recent years, India's military, diplomatic and economic energies have expanded far beyond Nehru's non-aligned position. But what does that mean for India, its region and to the United States? Unquote. If we really had a secured firm footing in global eyes as a power to reckon with, why then do we still have to encounter so much uncertainty when it comes to American visas for Indian skilled workers? Why then is the list of countries that allows Indians without a visa for travel not expanding? Why do we still not see the effects of our own thinking that we're a global power? Why is simply that not manifesting in the way the world sees us? The article by Dormandy states that India's foreign policy is driven by five principal considerations in which are woven its relationships with the United States and China. And as I said earlier, how we deal with the world is inextricably linked with how we deal with our own internal security and economy and other issues. As she says, as is necessary for any nation, India's principal priority is ensuring conventional security for its country and its people. In recent years, India has built up a strong and capable army, navy and air force, the third, fourth and seventh largest in the world respectively. This is, of course, at the time of writing in 2007, these forces have grown larger since. She went on to say, India's military is not only large, but effective, well-trained and increasingly well-equipped. Their air force has been known to best that of the United States in combat air exercises, unquote. And there is the question of Pakistan. We quote the writer again, who says, India's main conventional threat is perceived to be Pakistan. These two nations had a military standoff in late 2001 and early 2002 following an attack on the Indian parliament. While India is militarily vastly larger than Pakistan, this numerical supremacy is somewhat mitigated by the topographic limitations of their western border, which restricts the number of troops that India could deploy against Pakistan at any one time. And as always, there has been the looming shadow of China since the 1962 war. But how have we dealt with the China problem since then? According to the writer, while India has committed to expanding and modernizing its air force and maintaining the stature and strength of its army, three principal reasons have motivated their desire to expand their blue water navy and build a submarine force. Number one, to counter China's expansion into the region. Number two, to ensure the continued safe flow of goods and natural resources through the Bay of Bengal and beyond, particularly the area around the Malacca Straits, which is still very susceptible to piracy and through which approximately one half of the world's oil flows. And number three is India's desire for a nuclear triad, which is the missing leg of which today is a submarine force. While not trying to create an offensive capability, in the words of Admiral Suresh Mehta, the chief of Indian Naval Staff at that point, India is looking for mutual respectful partnerships that ensure the stability of the Indian Ocean, unquote. Since then, that article was of course written in 2007, we have actually gone ahead on the nuclear submarine front. On the 4th of November 2018, Modi, Prime Minister Modi, announced that the Arihant, the Indian Navy's first domestically built nuclear-powered submarine, completed her first deterrence patrol. As National Interest reported, and I quote, the Arihant, which means slayer of enemies in Sanskrit, uses a uranium-fueled pressurized light water reactor to generate 83 megawatts of electricity, allowing the submarine to swim underwater for months at a time at speeds as high as 24 knots, unquote. Of course, there was the bizarre episode in 2016 when a hatch left open in port caused the 6,500-ton submarine to flood with corrosive salt water. The submarine had to be deployed on account of this, but it appears that now Arihant is in business. So as is clear, India or its leadership or its think tank never sought to politicize short-term gains, but to build diplomatic conduits as well as internal capabilities to strengthen the nation-state from within. Because if we don't deal with troubles inside, you will not know what foot to put outside. Aside from strengthening the nation-state and strengthening the army, navy and air force, how has India's record been while dealing with terror? Considering this piece that I'm quoting from was written in 2007, it is still easy to see the truth in many of the statements when the writer says, while India's military is designed to protect its borders from outside influence or powers, it should be noted that they also have a strong domestic role in fighting internal militancy, particularly in its northeast region, in Jammu and Kashmir, and against the Naxalite groups in the east. Notwithstanding these three sets of players, what is perhaps most surprising is that despite having the third largest Muslim population in the world after Indonesia and Pakistan, this was of course in 2007, now India has the second largest Muslim population, excepting the attempted suicide attacks in England over the past summer in 2006, there are no known Indian Al-Qaeda or Taliban members. This fact could suggest that India might have something to teach concerning anti-terrorist activities, unquote. Now, on the point of those data points, this was of course written in the pre-ISIS days, and recent reports have suggested that the Islamic State is actively trying to recruit members in India. And now, as far as Muslim population is concerned, since 2007, India is home to the second highest population of Muslims after Indonesia. According to Pew Research, by 2060, that is 2060, India will be home to 11.1% of the world's Muslim population, which will be the highest anywhere in the world. The percentage of Muslims in India is expected to be 19.4%. of the total Indian population. By and large, though, there does not seem to be much of a presence of these international Islamic fundamentalist organizations here in India. The piece also acknowledges that South Asia is an insecure region and India is surrounded on all sides by unstable democracies, conflict-ridden countries, militant activity, authoritarian leaders or weak governments, and countries with which India has historically had acrimonious relations. Quoting from the piece further, in order to ensure that such negative influences do not seep into India, despite the inherent cacophony described by its diverse ethnic and religious population and inequality, India has developed a strong democracy. This has enabled all parts of India's society to very differing degrees to engage in the political process, and a fact which is a fact that helps maintain domestic stability. It is greatly in India's interest to encourage others in the region to follow its example and in so doing improve the prospects of strong and continuous growth. Unquote. So exactly the point that without internal stability and the strengthening of democratic norms, we cannot hope to command credibility internationally. We're, of course, talking about the evolution of India's foreign policy, and it's time now to talk about the hits and the misses that we have had along the way. The piece points out policy mistakes like the disastrous expedition to Sri Lanka in the 1980s, in which India became dragged into the internal conflict there and which eventually led to the assassination in 1991 of India's former Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi. But as the piece says, India has conventionally used its diplomatic and economic leverage and soft power to help mitigate the conflicts of its neighbors, particularly Nepal, Sri Lanka, and Bangladesh. Quoting from the piece, India, the United States, and the UK together played a powerful role in persuading Nepal's King Gyanendra to stand down in February 2005. India continues to have influence in Sri Lanka and in Bangladesh and provide a demonstration effect for democracy to these countries. Unquote. In Afghanistan, India had built on its long-standing relationship with the Northern Alliance and Prime Minister Hamid Karzai to support stability, including providing over $750 million in assistance and infrastructure support. Quoting from the piece, it should be noted that India's interest in Afghanistan is not just historical. Lying as it does on Pakistan's western border, close relations with Afghanistan, as with Iran, constitutes a significant strategic asset to India. It is, of course, another matter that India's rebuilding efforts in Afghanistan have been mocked by Donald Trump, a man who knows his place nowhere except at the very heart of narcissistic darkness. And that aside, India's military has had a strong peace-building role, said the article, and as of March 2007, almost 12 years ago, India was the third largest provider of peacekeeping forces to the United Nations. It also commanded much global admiration as one of the founding four nations of the Asian Tsunami Core Group, and alone provided more aid and assistance than any other country except the United States. Moving on to the economy and how that has informed our foreign policy decisions, it is of course a given that any country that has a firm grip on its economy commands more attention internationally. And in this area, the writer traces India's journey from a GDP growth of approximately 3.5% per year till the 1980s to the times following the 1991 economic reforms led by then Finance Minister Manmohan Singh, when growth tripled, reaching 8% in 2004. But the writer also said that historically, India's growth has been internally driven, and it must draw on this international engagement further if it is going to continue to lift up the 60% of its population in the rural sector and develop a modern infrastructure. The writer also said that the US-India relationship has been focused on building economic engagement and investment between the two nations, despite sensitive aspects like the question of outsourcing. But something did change in the early 1990s, and that was, of course, the economic reforms. We saw that in the Indian government launched a look east policy intended to promote engagement between India and its Southeast Asian neighbors in the early 90s. Quoting from Xenia, the raison d'etre, that is the main reason of this policy, was economic. This policy never truly realized the hoped-for benefits, in large part due to the 1997 financial crisis that interrupted economic development in the region. Nevertheless, today, India is increasingly engaging with the Association for Southeast Asian Nations, that is ASEAN, including working on a free trade agreement, and continues to engage bilaterally with the members and others with trade agreements completed or in the process with such countries as Thailand, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Korea, Singapore, and Japan. Unquote. Even then, India's increasing engagement with China was stemming from the latter's exceptional economic growth of over 10% since 2000, and both India and China then saw their concurrent economic expansion as mutually beneficial. The future, however, was less clear, according to the writer, as India was increasingly focusing on the manufacturing sector, traditionally China's area of expertise. The piece also said that in 2007, in order to sustain economic growth at around 10%, India must ensure energy security as its third major area of focus. By 2025, said the writer, in 2007, it was projected that India will import 80% of its energy needs, complicated by the fact that it has dirty coal and its use will have severe environmental implications. But even then, India was beginning to pay more attention to environmental concerns, joining the Asian Pacific Partnership on Clean Development and Climate, and recently creating a Council on Climate Change. This was 12 years ago. This issue, even then, was increasingly becoming a political one, and the writer mentioned a poll conducted in 2006 where 51% of Indians considered global warming a critical threat. But that also meant that 49% did not. Here's hoping that in 2019 that has changed. In July 2005, a civilian nuclear agreement was inked between India and the United States to designate a good supply of fissile material to India to power its civilian reactors. Next up, the questions about nuclear capability and how that has informed our foreign policy. There are two nuclear weapons powers on India's borders, China and Pakistan. And given its history with both, the writer mentions how sensitive the country is to intimation of control by any other power, though it had till then steadfastly maintained a no-first-use policy, and subsequently a composite dialogue between India and Pakistan not only lowered the tensions, but also resulted in significant agreements that went in some way to mitigating the chance of a mistaken nuclear attack. So far, our policy has been no-first-use. The final priority of New Delhi's government was for India to take its rightful place on the global stage. In so doing, they recognized the importance of building their strategic stature and leadership. With 1.3 billion people, India has the second largest population in the world and one of the youngest, with over 50% under the age of 25. Our economy, by purchasing power parity, is fourth in the world after the US, China and Japan. Unlike America's, India's soft power has remained strong and our military, economic and diplomatic reach is increasingly significant. India is a multi-ethnic and multi-religious democracy accommodating a Hindu majority with the second largest Muslim population in the world. They're very eager. That is, we Indians are very eager to take up the role on the global stage that these characteristics support. While already a leader of the developing world, India now wants its status recognized in the developed world. Historically, India's ambition to play a bigger role was always based on internal strengths provided by its strong commitment to democracy, peace initiatives, policy of open dialogue and economic development principles it inherited from a Nehruvian, almost moralistic worldview. India is working not just in the bilateral sphere, but as we saw economically, it hedges its bets by engaging in regional and, as appropriate, ad hoc groups such as the December 2004 Asian Tsunami Core Response Group and, more recently, the quadrilateral group between Japan, US, Australia and India. India has an impressive array of memberships of regional organizations and continues to drive for more, including a formal association with the ASEAN and the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Group. While thus far, the goal of a permanent seat at the United Nations has been unsuccessful, it has resulted in a number of indirect benefits, both in terms of building a much closer bilateral relationship with Japan and in raising its profile as a serious contender following UN reform. Meanwhile, India continues to lead the G77 and the non-aligned movement and in this capacity negotiates on behalf of the developing nations in the UN General Assembly. And finally, what is the complex equation we've had with China and the US over the years? As the piece informs us, since the 1962 war, both nations have worked hard to ensure that their border conflicts do not spill over into their broader relationship and that other bilateral interests are not held hostage to these disagreements. Quoting from the piece, like the US, China has worked hard in recent years to improve its relationship with India while continuing to sustain its long-term relationship with Pakistan. Despite these efforts, however, the inherent relationship between China and India is one of tension, whether in the economic, energy, nuclear, strategic, or security realm. Without the continued careful attention by both parties to mitigate them, these pressures are likely to increase as both India and China take leadership roles in Asia. Pressure is also likely to rise as both nations expand economically, increasingly competing for foreign investment and supremacy in the services as well as manufacturing industries. Given these inherent pressures and yet the importance to both countries of a stable and secure environment in which to grow, the two nations will continue to maintain a dual policy of hedging and engaging one another, similar to that of US and China, in order to walk the narrow path between remaining friendly but protecting against the eventuality that the other does not. So, not much has changed in this respect since 2007 when those words were said. With the US also, India has had a fairly complicated relationship. Notwithstanding its non-aligned status from its independence until the end of the Cold War, India tilted towards the Soviet Union when the US engaged more actively with Pakistan. But in the early 1990s, such divisions began to fade, and India's foreign policy became more self-determining. In 2000, then-President Bill Clinton led a five-day path-breaking visit to India that transformed Indian views of the US and launched our new relationship. Former US Ambassador Robert Blackwell picked up the baton when he headed out to Delhi to be the ambassador to India for the Bush administration in 2001. What these moves illuminated then were the possibilities between the two countries. As became apparent, during Ambassador Blackwell's tenure, there were huge opportunities that could be realized by a closer bilateral relationship, although much work would be needed to make this possible. Unquote. Both India and the US have faced similar challenges like terrorism, extremism, proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, economic growth, energy, environment, narcotics, Afghanistan, and potentially China. So our relationship in many ways are very different, but the problems that we deal with are pretty much the same. As the piece suggests, in many cases, there are issues that cannot be resolved unilaterally, but that are going to require long-term engagement and cooperation, not just by the US and India, but many of our other allies. We will need to work together to address these mutual challenges. In countering terrorism, India has, for far longer than America, been subjected to a terrorist threat against its nation, and as stated earlier, has engaged its Muslim population in a manner that has not resulted in extremism or militancy, despite the potential provocation on its borders. In the area of weapons of mass destruction and proliferation, given India's location, it is arguably much more susceptible to these threats than is the US, whether from Pakistan, China, Iran, or even, well, North Korea. Similarly, India and the United States are necessary partners in dealing with the dual challenges of energy security and environmental degradation. As India's energy consumption increases, the two countries will need to work closely to ensure that environmental costs don't similarly grow and that investment is made on the most advanced equipment. Unquote. Unfortunately, though, as we speak, America is out of the Paris Accord and India continues to stay on it. As the article acknowledged then in 2007, as great democracies, India and the US have had similar world visions, as well as interest in promoting this form of government, albeit through the auspices of the United Nations. As our history tells us, India has provided a very effective demonstration effect for other nations in the region and beyond, without many of the sensitivities that, let's say, the United States brings to the table. But given India's five principal strategic interests, we can say that India could become a powerful force for transformation in times of peace and in strife as well, by not just following examples, but setting them itself. Now those, in a nutshell, to those of us unaccustomed to the intricacies of international relations, were the highlights of independent India's foreign policy evolution and some of the bedrocks of our foreign policy. How have things changed in the Modi years? And that question, we'll find some answers on our next part on this two-part series, India and the World. Do write into us, mcpodcast@nw18.com. Until the next time you hear from me, this is me, Rakesh Sharma, on behalf of the Money Control Podcast Desk, saying thank you for joining us and do stay with us on moneycontrol.com to be a smart listener and an even smarter investor.
This has been a Digging Deeper podcast, and you have been listening to Money Control.